and welcome back to the Research VR podcast, the podcast of the science and design of virtual reality. I am your host, Oz Balabanian, and with me today is Peter Lekoff.
Hello, everyone, and this time we are only me and Azad.
Yes, right. We're just going to have a solo sesh with Peter and Oz to talk a little bit about SIGGRAPH 2018. SIGGRAPH, as the name suggests, actually the name I've recently found out is like not a really a real shortening, or what do you call it, the one you use the first letters, abbreviation. I know there's like a more specific term. It's supposed to be like a graphics conference. It's made for essentially both game developers and VFX industry pioneers to be there, talking about their research, talking about, you know, what films they've been working on and what games they've been working on, and also for hardware manufacturers to come out and show some of their latest and greatest, specifically for people that care about graphics. So it was a pretty awesome show, and so today we kind of want to go through everything that I got to see. Unfortunately, Peter, you weren't with me.
No, this time, unfortunately, not.
Maybe next year.
Let's see.
We'll have enough to get everyone, or by everyone, I mean just us two together.
Well, I mean, if there is enough people who would help us and support us on Patreon, then the next flight might be actually doable, right?
Exactly. If you have been listening for a while and have found any sort of value, you know, a little bit of value, a lot of value, any sort of value, and you want to help us by keeping this channel alive, it would be incredible if you guys could help us out on the Patreon as well. We have different tiers ranging from $2 to $15. And I think there's a range on top of that as well. But every bit helps. We're trying to essentially have enough to so that we can go to conferences together and book a hotel. Like, we're not even trying to pay salary or anything.
No.
Obviously, we both have separate jobs and do different things. But it would be really cool if we could just cover conference costs for us to go.
Exactly.
However, I just got back yesterday from Vancouver, Canada, which is probably one of my kind of more favorite cities, especially on the northern side of America. And it's just a beautiful place that has like very efficient public infrastructure and public transit that places like San Francisco really does not have. So it's nice to be there. And like, I was probably a few kilometers away from the conference hall, and every day I was able to get on a bus and a train and get there. Ooh. Like pretty quickly. It was nice. But anyway, so today I want to kind of talk about a lot of my experiences, go a little bit into some of the hardware that I saw, and give some thoughts as to the whole conference itself. So without further ado, let's jump into it.
Yeah.
Okay, Peter. So the first thing I saw, I have all of my notes listed out here. The first thing I saw was from a developer friend of mine, and it was the Knuckles 2.
Ooh.
This is, the Knuckles 2.0 that Valve has released specifically for developers to get their hands on and start thinking about how they can create with kind of like second generation controllers, where finger tracking is going to be a big element. They added a thumbstick to the controller itself instead of a thumb pad, and they actually reduced the thumb pad to like just a scroll, almost like a scrollable finger up and down thumb pad, but it does also still have left and right like a capabilities to be able to scroll left and right, but it's mostly like a vertical cylindrical shape. And the grip sensors, those were definitely changed. So there's no button anymore. You get kind of like a capacitive and squeezable grip.
And did you like it?
So I don't know. Honestly, like, I think it's cool. And I think reading about it made me more excited about the Knuckles than when I tried it. Mm. And I only got to try it in one experience. I didn't have much time with it. It was, I think, a demo that a developer had made to just test out all the different use cases. And I was like, okay, this also, there's another problem where one of the controllers I was using, I think, had some issues with the button. So the developer had to request another set of gloves, and we weren't sure exactly if I had both the newest knuckles or if I was using one of the damaged ones. However, it felt the placement of like the thumbstick felt a little bit off. Like it was a little bit too away from where your thumbs comfortably rest on like an Xbox 360 or a PS3 controller. Wow, I'm dating myself on these. You can tell I haven't bought a gaming console in the last like 10 years. The grips were okay. I mean, I guess the finger tracking worked is a really nice big step in immersion. But the grip interaction and like squeezing something just felt like it was a lot of force to do something.
Okay.
To trigger a squeeze animation on a plushie boy, like a plushie toy. And I was like, I mean, it's cool, but I don't know how effective it's gonna be. And honestly, this is probably why they also did not give these headsets out to anyone apart from developers to try, because clearly like there's still a lot of ways to go, despite the fact that I think the plastic and just the build quality felt more polished and much more closer to like a real consumer object than the first the Knuckles 1.0, which I got to see like probably around this time last year.
Maybe do you know when the Knuckles will actually hit the market, and will they still change from what you tried
in terms of hitting the market? I don't think that's even a what do I want to say, like a
confirmed or whatever.
Yeah, or if that's even gonna specifically happen with these specific product, right? I think now, like, Valve gets to do what it wants to do, especially when it comes to releases. Like, there's nothing that they ever feel that they need a rush to market for. And sometimes even develop prototypes that they never do anything with. I'm not saying that's what this is, because it seems like it's a pretty sustained effort that they've been doing, right? Like, if they didn't think there was anything worth pursuing in this direction, they would not have probably made a secondary version that they, you know, publicly have announced and shown. But I think I'm probably having not the best impression of it, and I expect to like it more if I get to try it out more. But I think just the part that I think the biggest issue is that it's still not a very fast and fluid controller to hold, like put your hands into and hold and then take off and then put it back on, which okay. Like specifically with VR, what I end up doing is like a lot of the times taking my headset off and like doing and then something and then putting it back on, or like there's a lot of fidgeting with other things you have to do when you're in VR sometimes, and having controllers like that in your hands definitely can be kind of a barrier to even grabbing like a headset and moving it comfortably above your forehead.
That's interesting. So, I mean, honestly, what I've been most excited about is not so much the controller itself. I mean, it's very hard to debate that, you know, anything other than the Vive controller are pretty much more ergonomic, because when you just look at the standard Vive controller, it's just a stick with a ring.
Touch, dude.
So any improvement there is obviously good. But what I've seen from a lot of videos is also that they have some kind of hand model that is fit to this controller, and you can use your fingers, more similar to the Oculus Touch controllers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess this is the more interesting part, but I guess that also requires developers to support it. And
yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, I guess as a user, you won't get much benefit of it very soon.
The demo that I tried had like robotic hands, and I did not feel embodied in those hands at all. Not because they were robotic hands. Like I felt embodied in like Lone Echo and Echo Arena, just like by looking at my fingers and hands. And so it wasn't that, you know, they needed to be a specific texture of my hand. But I think I had a much more of a transformative experience with the Oculus Touch when I first tried that out. And I still kind of do. I like looking at my hands with the Touch, and I like looking, even though the finger tracking is like very, very, very basic.
Yeah.
It's still kind of nice to be able to point and see your finger move. But I guess it's just a little bit more robust with the knuckles. And yeah, I'm gonna stop from saying more things about it, because I think it's still an inconclusive opinion, and I should kind of hold off on it until I get a little bit better of a try. And there is a big chance that I had a defective. I was using the defective unit, and it was not registering as well as it should have. So, having said that,
Sure. I mean, you should at some point, you know, figure out a way to try some kind of toothbrush or anything with it. On the last weekend, I was playing around with blocks and I only had the mixed reality headset. And man, I mean, the mixed reality headset is cool in terms of, you know, being portable, but the precision was very, very bad. And
really?
From what I remember when I use, you know, the Oculus Touch controllers, like it's very nice to do blocks or tilt brush or whatever. The Vive controllers is fine, but my hands get a little bit tired soon. The mixed reality controller was just very unprecise. So I'm wondering if the Knuckles will be, you know, very easy to use for interacting with VR because they're just strapped to your hand and you're not getting tired of holding them. Maybe long-term usage testing or whatever.
Yeah, that's true. That is very true. I wonder how it changes when you don't have to hold something and it's kind of resting on your hand. If that's a, I guess that makes sense on your finger tendons, I guess, in your forearm. That whole thing.
Okay. What was the other amazing things that you see?
Yeah, let's talk more. Like, let's go deeper into SIGGRAPH. So the first demo I tried was a let me get my spec straight. It was a VR experience called the Cave VR, it was a virtual reality film called The Cave, and it was a shared VR cinematic experience made by the NYU Future Reality Lab. So this is a multi-user mixed reality experience where they had like three phases when you kind of step in. The first phase is them showing you a tech demo of their Bose audio system that they've been using. And these are like newly built Bose glasses that are supposed to have these beamforming speakers that act like headphones, but aren't actually headphones. You know, they're nothing sits in or on your ear. It's like the frame of the glasses actually have speakers in them that are shooting, audio into your ear. However, the place we were trying this out in was like also filled with 20 or 30 other people trying these headsets out, and it was like kind of loud because of that, or at least like the situation was not ideal to be having non-sound insulated speakers. So at least that was like the Bose demo, and I was like, okay, you know, this is a prototype that they're showing, and it's not the film. So the second phase was the film itself, and the film was pretty cool. They had basically 30 people sitting in a room facing a center where like the action was going to happen, kind of like a theater show. It was like a small black box theater, and everyone was wearing a Lenovo MR headset. This is the Google version, I guess. Is it a Daydream headset, right? The Sixtoff?
Yes, the Mirage. Yeah.
No, it's the Google Mirage with custom Bose like sound beamforming speakers that were a variant of the previous prototype that they were showing. So I was really concentrating on like the experience of having other people around me, because I think that was one of the bigger features that they were trying to experiment with.
How did you perceive them?
So you perceive them as avatars sitting around you, and if they were connected, then they would be blue, or if there was no one in that headset in that seat, you know, it would be black.
Interesting.
The demo that I saw was the first ever showing that they did publicly, and they were having a little bit of connectivity issues. So some people would just like drop in and out of the shared session.
Can I be sarcastic?
So, yeah.
I mean, yeah, you know, how could anyone predict that 30 people using some kind of Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, wireless connection in room that is inside a conference with thousands of people
conference
could have connectivity issues? I mean,
yeah.
Very unpredictable.
I feel like conferences are always the worst case scenario for VR or any of these systems to work at their best, and they're always that, you know, that's the one place where people go to experience them. So kind of, it's the test, it's the ultimate test,
the stress test.
The sound, I really have to say, was kind of a highlight of the experience as well, because they were doing something clever with splitting the higher frequencies of the sound to the Bose speakers on your headset, and then keeping the low end frequencies of everything, right? Both the dialogue, but also the music, to be in the room speakers.
Wait,
with a big
subwoofer. How did you notice it? Because from my experience, it's very hard to figure out the directions that, you know, the bus, so basically the low frequency they're coming from. You're very bad at detecting their location, right? So how did you figure it out?
I mean, technically, I guess you're not supposed to really be able to tell, right? That's you're way less, you're way worse at being able to tell direction for low frequencies.
Exactly. And,
I don't know. I guess if you try hard enough, you can know. But also, like, it didn't feel like. No. It also doesn't feel like, you know, there's a subwoofer on your ear. It's like you can feel the bass all by your feet as well. You're like, oh, okay, like, you know, not everything is coming from these beamforming speakers. Mm-hmm. But that it makes sense to split it up that way, because the dialogue, when you know, we're looking around the scene, the dialogue remained in the same place. And you could also probably do some more clever, you know, audio tricks with stereo, with than, you know, just having speakers in a room. But although I think that's a really interesting thing that I guess you can only do in a cinema situation, is have really nice speakers and the direction of the speakers also be a part of the VR experience, and perhaps, you know, have like multiple sources of speakers, one that are on your ears, one that's in the room in different directions, and be able to, you know, have that be an element.
Yeah, I guess in a sense we are approaching maybe some kind of technological breakthrough where it might be also happening at home. I mean, if you look at the Sonos systems and how the Oculus Go has also some kind of beamforming stuff, and, you know, mm-hmm. basically a lot of experiments going in the direction where, you know, shitty speakers become good speakers by applying magic to them. I assume that when, you know, the industry is smart enough and Samsung has integrated, because Samsung integrates everything into their speakers, let's say at some point might release, then when you enter your home, maybe your headset will figure out, okay, I'm now in the home and I will switch in a mode where I'm using, you know, the speakers that are in home anyway, like the bus system or whatever. And then it might actually be that you're sitting at home in any place in your room, but, you know, your sound system is somehow coupled with your VR system. Who knows?
Maybe. I mean, like I said, I don't know how much it makes sense for consumer tech, just because, you know, that's asking for a lot to have all this synced ecosystem devices, and it makes sense for cinemas to be able to do it that have control over you know, all the hardware. But maybe there is a consumer direction as well.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, like, I enjoyed the film. I think it's nice to be able to see other people in an experience with you, because that is a big part of why you go to the cinema, is to emote with other people, and to, you know, when they laugh, you laugh. That you end up actually, I think there's even some research that a friend was pointing to, that you do emote more because the people around you are emoting. There's like some quantitative numbers as to how much more you laugh when you're watching a comedy in a cinema versus watching it at home. However, I guess the one critique would be that the film I didn't see other people really emoting. Like, there, you know, there weren't like gasps or like, I don't know, emotions coming out of the people for that to affect me as well. And so perhaps, like, you know, different forms of content would maybe work better for having 30 people in a room together. And when I talked to them, it seemed like they didn't really, they wanted to keep everything to just having an experience in a real theater rather than having like virtual sessions with, mm-hmm. you know, people. And it didn't particularly seem that you know, there was anything special for them being in the room with you versus being, you know, over a VoIP session, which, you know, you can argue there's big differences in quality in terms of voice. You know, if you hear them laugh, it's probably going to be better if they're laughing in real life versus over VoIP. But anyway, cool. Those are just kind of some raw thoughts as to the cinema. The SIGGRAPH really did have a few good examples of like, or a few different implementations of how cinema can be, how you can integrate VR experiences into like multi people theaters and cinemas. And so that was a cool kind of theme that I was seeing all throughout. And it seems like it's maturing in that sense. Like, it's less and less you'll see just like a video playing, you know, unsynced video playing on like 50 devices, and, you know, people are having technical issues and they're like having to figure it out. Like, it seems like people are building software to actually sync everything together and have social experiences in VR.
Very interesting. I mean, let's see how the trend develops, right?
Yeah, exactly. So moving on, there was a Niantic multiplayer AR demo. Niantic, the people behind Pokemon Go, are gearing up to release, I think, a Harry Potter AR experience. And the demo they had playing at SIGGRAPH involved kind of like casting spells by pressing things and then picking up gems and like picking up these power-ups as you're running around to shoot back at your friends that have phones as well. And
I'm looking right now at the videos that we have on the Research VR Cast Twitter page, and people seem to be tracked too, right? So you have your phone in front of the camera, and the people have some kind of augmentation line towards them. How do they track people?
I don't know. Like, it's a cross-platform multiplayer session, so this is something that you can't really do with ARKit or ARCore. This was fully their own implementation of AR and multiplayer.
But do they tracking also by their own algorithms, or are they relying on ARCore and ARKit tracking technology?
I don't know. I mean, from what I remember having spoken to them, they said they needed to build their own way of doing things. So I guess it's their own SLAM method. I don't know if it's like built on an open, algorithm already, but it seemed like they were very happy with the latency that they were able to achieve even between, Android and iPhone devices. And you can tell from the video, like it's six to the player, you don't see any kind of ghosting of the real life and the virtual avatars. So that was really interesting. And I guess games like that will come out and they'll be kind of cool. So we'll see how that goes. The third thing I saw that I think I would like to talk about is Disney Animation's, their first kind of VR film, their first VR experience, called Cycles. And, this was a full, I think kind of like 5 to 10 minute experience built in Unity where you stand in the middle of this house and a story unfolds in front of you, around you, and all throughout. And I guess I shouldn't really talk about too much, like, I can't talk too much about the story without spoiling it. So I guess we can also talk about, like, the different design decisions that they made to direct attention and to have people experience what they should be experiencing. So the first thing I noticed is that I think this was the first time I've ever seen a time lapse happen in VR. Apart from, 360 video time lapses, this was kind of the first time I've seen a six-DOF Unity time lapse, which was kind of neat. And they're also playing with non-linear storytelling lines, so they were kind of jumping back and forward in the timeline. And at first, I wasn't sure what was going on, but then I kind of put it together that they were, I think, going backwards. But the one interesting thing was that the way they wanted to direct your attention is that if you, wherever the story was happening in that particular scene, if you looked away from that point of view, the colors went to black and white. And so there's a very like distinct visual cue to keep you looking at a specific direction. I thought that was cool at first, but I think as the story was progressing, it felt almost a little bit too restrictive. Where I was like, I mean, if you don't want me to I know I understand direction and everything, but it seems like a little too heavy handed when it comes to like, no, don't look at that. Look at this, and like almost like blocking your vision from looking at other things.
I mean, I would bring a counter argument, particularly after, having the Oculus Go and reading through a lot of reviews in the store. And following what people write about this device, if I would be developing anything that requires me to rely on the user, I would not rely on the user and force him. I think that with the mass adoption that XR is going to have and doing right now might also require someone like those studios to make sure that even so for power users something might be super annoying, like an introduction or whatever in the beginning, please don't move too much, you can walk against walls. Maybe it's still important.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, you really do have to treat everyone as like new baby borns when it comes to like just a fully outward facing, mainstream product that you don't know who's going to be experiencing these things versus like a smaller demo that you can target specifically to like veteran VR people. But no, I think it was a cool story, and the art style was actually beautiful. So I was excited to be in a Disney animation in VR. Nice. And you can really tell that there was a lot of polish on the art. Yeah, I think, I mean, I wish it was a little bit longer, because I did see some like 20 to 30 minute films at SIGGRAPH this time around. And I was like, I was really into those. I didn't feel rushed at all to kind of get out or, you know, got bored. Like I watched those 30 minute films and I was really into it. So good first step for Disney, and excited to see more. So the fourth thing that I saw was a interactive music video, or kind of like a music experience called Chorus. And it was a Justice song, actually, like the band Justice that's been around for quite some time. Kind of like that electronic band from like, I think, early 2000s. Yeah, this was one of their film or one of their songs, and a VR version of it, where it was a fully against Unity experience, where it was four people in Vives picking an avatar, like, or picking a character at first, and then becoming these like interdimensional space women warriors, and you then battle this like also interdimensional space creature as the song progresses, and it's like different kind of chapters throughout the song and different things happen, and each character has like their own weapon, and it was like a really fun way of, you know, engaging people into the song. And also, if there's some kind of like lore behind the song, you know, if you can think of like Tenacious D's The Greatest Song in the World, you know, there's like a very specific visual element that goes along with that song. With things like that, I think, and it makes a lot of sense to actually put listeners or the audience into that world and have them like battle along as the song is going on. So I thought that was really neat. Yeah, I had a good time. And you also have like voice chat with others, and you have like different characters are bigger and smaller scales, so you can kind of also play with each other in that sense. Like, you know, it's kind of scary for like the small person to have like a 10-foot sized giant. Well, hopefully it's their friend, you know, that's doing the trickering.
Yeah, the friendly giant who will smash you with his feet, yeah.
Yeah. And after that, I immediately went into the SIGGRAPH VR theater, which was a theater that SIGGRAPH made for like I think they selected like 20 or 30 different films and have a curation of like four films per viewer. So as you go inside, it's like this nice dome with a projection mapping on the inside, and you go and like sit in a chair, and an attendant comes and gives you a headset, and it was a Rift that they're all running in, with their own kind of software that's a launcher. And you have no control, so you have no controllers in your hand. And the software has like four films that it shows you at first, like the titles come up, and then it jumps into the first one immediately, and you watch that, and then go through the other ones. Unfortunately, like none of these were synced across, so it's like much more of like, you know, you go in, you sit down, and you watch it, and you walk out when it finishes. And in that way, they have like a faster turnaround time of like people, you know, individuals just going in, sitting down, plugging in and watching. And I actually didn't have too much of a problem. I thought at first that wouldn't be too interesting, but it ended up being like a nice little relaxing session in the middle of a crazy conference. Was like to go in, you know, it's like almost like a hibernation pod, to, you know, sit in and just like kick back, watch this thing. You don't even have to care about, you know, you're not watching the same thing as others, so I guess the others did not matter as much. And it's very much like going into a massage parlor with everyone having their own experience.
So kind of you see maybe this to develop in, you know, those pots and airports or malls where you're just tired, you just sit for half an hour and watch stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I wish there was more pods like that in airports, but yeah, I know exactly the one you're talking
about. I saw recently a pod where you can sleep.
Yeah, they're Japanese pods, and like capsules, I think is what they're called. And yes. I slept in one in the Moscow airport when I was there for like 11 hours last year.
Nice. Yeah, maybe they will soon have VR.
Mm-hmm. That could be cool.
Some premium adult content.
I saw a few films in this experience that I do want to point out to. So I guess, yeah, this podcast will have a little bit more film content than most other podcasts we've done. But it was nice. I haven't like actually spent time watching films in VR for quite some time. You know, so it was really interesting to see kind of how far we've come over the last couple of years. So the first film I saw was called Trinity. And it was made by UNLTD, so I think that might be Unlimited, but I don't know if that's what the name stands for. And it was a 360, like kind of like live action, as well as built mixed in with some CG, like fully CG scenes that was built in Unity. And it was a pretty cool sci-fi kind of action flick. I was kind of, when it first started, I was like, okay, let's see if, you know, this is going to be interesting enough to watch in 360, just because I don't know, I'm not the biggest fan of 360 films. And what I really liked is that they were going in between like live action to suddenly a point cloud version of that live action, where the point clouds was sixed off and you could really kind of move your head left and right and get a better sense of both the actors and the environments.
Any idea how they did it?
Yeah, so I mean, the whole thing was running in a Unity build, and it was going from, at certain points they were overlaying like Unity particles on top of the 360 environment, so like even that was the particles were sixed off, but then suddenly the live action would go away to just having like a point cloud version of the environment and the actors. So yeah, I like that aspect of it, but I don't know if I'm jaded in the sense that I'm perhaps looking for that, and like for a normal audience member like that doesn't know, you know, a thing or two about VR or sixed off, they're, you know, it's all the same, and they're like, you know, cool, and they're thinking perhaps more in terms of like the story and the experience. But I mean, I'm just, I guess, talking about the experience that I had with it and if I liked it or not. So if you know what I like, then you can adjust your bias meter to the Oz side and understand.
Welcome to the weekly report of what Azad liked and what you should try as well.
Yeah, kind of, right? Or like what Oz and Peter like and what they think is worth pointing out. I mean, that's pretty much,
because we are objectively the experts.
We're objective experts on what we think. On the bias of Oz and Peter, you know, like nobody else can be as objective about the things that we like, which already has so much bias, right?
Yeah. Okay,
that makes no sense. But it was at least a film that I wanted to point out, just because I thought they were doing some interesting maneuvers. It looked like it cost a lot of money. Ooh. Like there was quite a few actors in it, like. It was a huge cast at the end. There was like just like a lot of just like flashy, beautiful things. Oh, there was one scene that you actually control, like in the point cloud world, you control this like being from a third person, like a firebird point cloud being, and then you fly through this point cloud and it sucks up the points. And it was like, oh, this is nice. Like suddenly, and you control it by like looking around. So it was like a very refreshing thing to suddenly have control over like a thing, and you don't notice it at first because you're just watching, but then suddenly when you like jitter your head, you realize that like, oh, this thing that's in front of me is actually moving in the direction that I'm looking. So that was great. I think that was a nice refreshing scene to have in a film. There's another thing I do want to talk about, which is Arden's Wake, and this is from Penrose Studios, who did like Alumet a few years ago. This was their fourth film, and I have to say this was probably one of the best things that I've seen in VR yet. It's a fully CG, or it was an animation in VR, pretty sure like built in Unreal, that you get to watch. And the scale, I guess I should also talk about scale, because the other films that I've been watching have all been full one-to-one human scale. Mm-hmm. Arden's Wake is like all the characters are much, much smaller. And you're within this world that you're within this house in one of the scenes, and you get to like look around at the three characters that are interacting across the house. And it works really well. The scale that they picked and the amount of space that you have around a swivel chair as you're sitting in it is like, you can tell was like very finely optimized, so that you can lean into the details that you want to look at, like on the character and like what they're picking up and what they're doing. But you could, then you can lean back and look at the other character and see kind of how they're interacting. And at a certain point, like there was three characters that were in like three different rooms or sections of the house, all interacting. And it was like a battle of like trying to look at which one and kind of understanding, like it was a comedic scene. And, I wasn't confused at which one to look at, but you could have picked and chosen a different character at any point. So anyway, that was actually a really nice scene. The opening scene was incredible. It starts off underwater and they just do like, they pick the location of the characters just so well, so that you can come up really close and look at them and like look around them. Nice. Just by leaning. And that being able to look around a character like that really makes you feel the immersion of yourself in a story. I think that's like it actually brings the characters to life to be able to feel that you have some sort of, I don't want to use these words. It's like the scale of the players being that small and you being that close to them makes those characters come to life. In more ways than being there in a one-to-one scale and, you know, having to use teleport or even smooth locomotion to get closer. And the final film I want to talk about is an anime actually called The Tales of Wedding Rings by Maybe. And it was actually produced by Square Enix. Ooh. Who actually, I did not know this, that Square Enix actually is a huge manga production company in Japan. And they like produce a lot of manga and anime apart from the video games that we know of here in the West. But I tweeted that Arden's Wake was like the best film that I'd seen at that point, which was the first day. But then the second day I watched this anime, and honestly, this was the longest film I saw in VR. This was like, I think just a little bit over 30 minutes. Whoa. And wow, dude, I think they have like really figured out like the rule, not, oh God, I don't want to say rules. They have really figured out the language of like what they can do with film and VR. And it's funny because it doesn't really involve the full 360 immersion of you as a person in a scene. As we kind of know, like anime and manga have their own, the frames in which manga is drawn. And for people that, I guess, that don't know, manga is like comic books, you know, anime comic books. The frames that are drawn have a language of telling you the emotion in the scene, or like the transition between one frame to the other, where you should be looking. And there's a lot to, you know, like how each shot is framed. So they apply the same thinking into VR, so that each frame, each like manga cutout actually is a world. It's a magic window into that frame. And so in a specific scene, you might actually have two or three frames that come up. I think they didn't have any more than two at a time usually. And each one of those frames actually has like a world inside. And even though those shots are in the same world, like in the same room, but they are different shots. And so they have different depth and planes. And it just was like such a refreshing way of watching something, like a shot, like watching a conversation in VR, I think is kind of hard because you need to figure out, like, especially in 360, you need to figure out where to put the characters so that you can see both, you know, you don't have to like swivel your head too much. But having frames actually come up like that, you could really set the camera anywhere you want. Yeah. and show the details. But it was honestly just so masterful of how they were doing these transitions between different scenes, between different frames. Sometimes for like environment or like setting shots, they would actually remove the frame. The frame would come and engulf you, you know, encapsulate you into the full 360 immersive shot. And then more frames would come up and then kind of like progress through the story. And like, they just really, you could tell they spent so long on trying to understand how to shoot things in VR, how to set you in this environment, and how do you deal with, you know, the language that we all know so well in terms of film and or in terms of like comic books, and the translating that into VR. And I was talking to the director for quite some time, and it seems like even the engineers that he was working with had like didn't understand that what he was trying to go for in terms of these like magic window panels, but he pushed hard, like hard enough that they eventually, like after they built some prototypes, people were like, oh, like this is something really interesting. Mm-hmm. And we should pursue this. And I didn't know that it was already released, but it's actually available on Oculus Home now, and soon on Steam. So, and I would recommend everyone to go and check that out. Again, the name of the film is Tales of Wedding Rings by Maybe. I'm not sure exactly who Maybe is, but yeah, Tales of Wedding Rings. It's a story of a boy and a girl that meet when they were young. And they have like a promise together, and then some magical things happen. And you know, it's an anime manga story. It's it has certain elements that you could expect. So, but just from a film,
kind of yeah, it's in the current trend of those comic/semi-comic apps that I've been seeing a lot on the Oculus Go store, which kind of surprised me because I didn't somehow thought myself of, you know, comics being engaging and useful in some kind of, you know, VR environment. But surprisingly, from what I've tested, I mean, I haven't tested the one that you tried, but I've seen it's kind of, you know, there seem to be a lot of effort to play around with how to transform a comic into VR, how to combine cinematic scenes with comic scenes and whatever. So, I mean, maybe some of the listeners know Max Payne 2 or Max Payne 1, where they were basically having this shooter game where you run around from a third person perspective, but in between the scenes you would have these comics that unfold, and it was kind of a very interesting combination. And it kind of reminded me a lot of that, what you described. Not sure.
Yeah, I actually haven't seen Max Payne, or I mean, I haven't played Max Payne. But it just, I think if people approach this medium with a little bit more of like, rather than trying to reproduce the examples that they've already seen, but really try to push against some ideas that people have put forward and try to like make their own version of what they think VR could be, I think you can create some films like this. And this one just worked so well for me. I showed it to a friend of mine, and she grew up in Taiwan, and when she came out of there, and she was like, oh my God, like, this is literally like I felt like I was in, like living the childhood dreams of like watching anime and being there. And it didn't require you embodying an avatar. It didn't require even the scale to be like 1-to-1 for certain shots. And for certain frames, like the scale was completely different because, the shot was an insert, like looking at a phone, looking at a text messages on a phone. That would be really hard to do if it's in 1-to-1 scale. So, you know, it's way zoomed in, and, I've been talking about this for, or I guess I've been thinking about this for quite some time in terms of how much of the cinematic language can we learn from and bring into VR with us. And I think there's so much there that we have learned over the last 100 years that we can learn from. And at the end, everything doesn't have to be 360 or even 180 or even fully immersive. Absolutely. But I think just having spatial computing be a part of how we display content, I think, is really important. So I think I'll be talking more about this idea soon. I have this documentary that I've been working on that I don't know if I've talked about on the podcast
before. I've
mentioned it on the Discord, and I've even posted a build, like an early concept, a proof of concept of what I was building That is around this idea of the frame in VR, of these magic windows that have real worlds through them. But anyway, I think when I'm ready to talk more about that, we definitely will talk stay about tuned, it on this podcast. Yeah, stay tuned. If you want to get a good glimpse of it, or I guess see like the really good version of it, watch this Wedding Rings film. Cool. I think the last few things I want to talk about. Oh, I should have even talked about this in the beginning. The Star VR headset.
Yeah.
Wow. I really should have talked about this in the beginning. This is by far the highlight of SIGGRAPH for me. So who is Star VR? Star VR is a combination of Star Breeze Studios and Acer. Star Breeze is, if you guys remember from a few years ago, they had their own high FOV headset that they built, and then I don't know if they got acquired by Acer or kind of somehow merged, but they, you know, the union of the two created Star VR, and this is their first their headset called the Star VR 1. It is a 210 degree horizontally and 130 degree vertically FOV AMOLED screen that has eye tracking for foveated rendering and for IPD adjustment, which is super, super cool. And being an AMOLED screen, you know, it has true black. It has true black, so the pixels actually turn off, and I'm pretty sure like a pretty wide color gamut. I wasn't able to get which if it was a P3 color gamut or not, but it was much wider than what is available today. Unfortunately, it's a headset that is only directed at B2B companies, or it's a headset only directed to enterprises. So I don't think they're going to be releasing this for consumer use soon. And I can only imagine what the price is probably going to be like. I would suspect multiple thousands. But the cool thing is that they have two versions of the headset. One that is a SteamVR headset that works with a Vive controller and with Lighthouse 2.0s, as well as another version that can be implemented with your own tracking solution. So whether that's
OptiTrax or whatever,
any of the other tracking system, they'll be able to support. I think their initial version of the headset, not this new version that came out, had only an Opti. No, what's the Was it WorldViz?
No, WorldViz is a company that builds this weird engine for creating stuff.
There was another tracking system.
Yes. There is OptiTrax.
Not OptiTrax, not Vicon. But it was in. It uses RF, I remember. But anyway, so they basically kind of announced, they've fixed a lot of the problems that a lot of clients, I guess, were complaining about, which is being able to use SteamVR. Especially for location-based entertainment, yeah. I think it might reduce some complexity and a lot of cost.
I mean, it's also price. I mean, OptiTrax for, let's say, a huge room costs, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60,000. And from my understanding of particularly the B2B customers, the only reason you would have a version that supports anything else than the Vive tracking is that companies usually have it already installed, like labs at universities or companies have some kind of tracking stuff there. And particularly when you're playing around with making objects trackable in VR, then you would rather rely on this OptiTrax system, which seems to, at least from what we experienced during a recent exhibition, interact with or like interfere with the Vive tracking, because it also uses infrared light, and the Vive tracking system also sends out the laser beams. So you can't really combine them. So when a company anyway wants to use OptiTrax, and they need some kind of other tracking stuff.
Yeah. Exactly, and from what it seems like, especially with the SteamVR version, it works with any SteamVR app, and so like I was the first experience I tried was Arizona Sunshine, and they even have the software version of like being able to constrict the FOV to what is available today, and that's how they started the demo. So you put it on, and you're like, huh, like this doesn't look that different from a Rift or a Vive. And they're like, watch this. They press a button and then the shutters or the blinders just open up to your side. And I was like, whoa, this is cool. I think I had seen an extra wide headset before, and I believe it was the Virgin Ears Monster. the VRgineers monster 5K display. However, all these like extra wide FOV headsets that I've seen have always felt that it's just kind of like a stretching of the screen rather than your vision becoming wider, even though it's not. And that's mostly due to the vertical FOV constriction. So, you know, if you have an extra wide horizontal display, it only makes the vertical display seem that much more limited. And I guess they fixed that in this, where they increased the vertical FOV to 130 in both directions. So, and where you notice this the most actually is vertically, like you see the sky a lot clearer. Just by looking straight forward, you can, you know, get a good glimpse of the sky without having to look straight up. But I have a good video on the Research VR podcast Twitter of showing with my hands what the FOV difference is from you know, what is 110 degrees today to 210 degrees. And my arms are fully out, like 180, you know, fully 180 degrees apart from each other, and I could still see them in the headset. That to me was really cool. Oh, and I was talking about Arizona Sunshine. The game, I could literally see the occlusion culling on the sides of my vision of like, that's how wide of a perspective it was of what I was playing. Like you could see things popping in and out of the world.
It's amazing. I can only imagine what you must have felt, because I recently had this new version of the VRgineers headset that has also this, you know, automatic IPD and a leap motion inbuilt and whatever, and they also support the vive tracking system apparently. And what struck me like the most is not only the FUV, because this is something that is really impressive, particularly for watching movies or enjoying stuff, but like the pixel density was so high that I barely saw the pixels. And I was looking at some kind of 3D rendered car and some kind of cut software, and it looked so sharp and so amazing. And I mean, if it has also foveated rendering as a Star VR, it works amazing. And
yeah,
I mean, I'm literally considering, you know, to sell my liver and get one.
So I don't know what the resolution numbers are, actually. They didn't tell it to me. And I asked them, and they were like, well, we're not really concentrating on that aspect.
But have you seen the pixels?
I don't think. Yeah. So I spent some good time in it, and I was thinking about, you know, is this more dense? And I believe the pixels per degree, what they told me is like 16, which I don't know what to compare that to. Apparently it is higher than what exists today, but it's not
pixels per degree. Interesting.
Yes. I might be totally wrong on that number.
I'm not sure if it's, you know, a lot or not a lot at all.
Right. Yeah. But in terms of feel, like it, the screen door effect is way reduced.
Okay.
I guess also the pixel configuration, like what they told me is a custom display, that they have designed and built with. I don't know who was building it, but I don't know anyone apart from like Samsung. Yeah, right. Like who else from Samsung has an AMOLED display?
I mean, maybe I would just assume maybe they also use some kind of flexible screen, because what you just described is something that I could imagine would be very nice to use a bendable screen in, right? So you kind of bend it around the headset.
Dude, that's actually a great point. Like, they've been trying to build these bendable phones and bendable screens.
No, but the screens are there.
Yeah, the screens are totally there, but they just haven't had a real use until, exactly. I guess if you apply it into a VR headset.
Curved monitors, and there are certainly curved phones, and Samsung and whatever companies shown screens that are pretty durable, but I think for VR it's just perfect. You can basically curve it around the person.
That's a great point. I guess, yeah, it felt similar to like a Vive Pro density, but again, the field of view, I can't understate that enough, like how cool that feels
more. See, with the VRgineers headset, I had definitely the feeling, okay, I barely see any pixel, or I don't see them, and you know, it's very high dense, I could read text here. But when this headset is pure B2B, then I guess higher FUVs only for displaying content in some kind of movie /
No, I mean, I wouldn't try to limit it in that sense. I don't think it's like that niche of a feature to add that it needs like very specific use cases. I think it's overall just a much better experience to be in VR in that sense. And if I could have one, and especially since it runs off of just Steam VR, like, and it, you know, you could do anything with it that exists in VR already, I think it's just a huge step
up. How heavy was it?
What exists. It was light. It was like, I think, I'll have to check the stats again, but it felt lighter than what I've felt recently with like a Vive.
Okay. Well, I mean, like the Vive Pro is pretty proper, chunky, to be honest. So yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. It felt pretty solid. The other thing we should talk about is their, yeah, eye tracking and foveated rendering. So, when you put it on, it actually, there's like these three bars that come up that show the ideal position and your position of the headset to your face, and you kind of like micro adjust it to match the three lines. And once that's done, it automatically tells you your IPD, which like that's their kind of like adjustment mechanism in the beginning to measure your eyes and adjust the displays accordingly. And that was pretty cool. I was like, this is exactly what we need with like generation two headsets is auto IPD adjustment. And honestly, I was kind of surprised the Magic Leap didn't have anything like that. Like that it required you to use their iPhone app and put a card to your forehead, like literally like a credit card you have to put on your forehead for it to use as a reference point and then adjust your eyes.
I remember when I first time tried the HoloLens during a CeBIT a few years ago, I was like, it's a special secret room that Microsoft has set up, and they even had like a special device that measures your IPD from a doctor. So I mean, you can really over-engineer this issue.
But a HoloLens doesn't have IPD adjustment. Yeah, but it doesn't have eye tracking.
No.
Where the Magic Leap does.
The Magic Leap has eye tracking?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, 100%.
I really need at some point to, you know, get away to try this headset because, for example, I totally missed the fact that they are doing this cardboard measurement for IPD. Interesting.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm sure this is going to be such a normal feature in about a year to a year and a half, I think, with at least the higher end headsets.
Yeah.
But the fact that, yeah, so once you have eye tracking, which I believe they're using to the Tobii eye tracking system.
Interesting.
You also have foveated rendering, which, I mean, amazingly, I did not notice in VR, which is a good thing because that's how foveated rendering is supposed to work. But being outside of the headset and seeing my friend in there, they had a circle around the high resolution fovea that they're rendering, and then you could see the fall off of both reflections and resolution away from that circle.
And does it work with any apps? Or?
Yes, so it's in their SDK basically for both Unreal and Unity. And the developer can choose to integrate it or not, but I think you would be at a severe disadvantage if you didn't, because you just wouldn't be able to maximize like the GPU that you have.
Yeah, I would actually rephrase it. You would not be able to run it on any GPU.
Sure. Maybe. I mean, so they were running the demo that I saw, I think Arizona Sunshine on, was running on a 1080, and it was great. Like the extra FOV didn't really do that, like wasn't really taxing the system as much. And talking to their CTO, he was saying, rather than really try to like, they're not with enterprise applications, you know, for B2B purposes, they don't really care as much about
fidelity.
Trying to maximize. Yeah. Or they want to maximize fidelity on whatever hardware they have access to. So yeah, it also keeps the low end spec of the headset, like at the same as the generation one, which I think was going to be really big for consumer headsets moving forward. Like that's why foveated rendering is going to be extremely important for both like high end headsets to integrate, but also lower end mobile headsets, because it'll keep the compute requirements to what it was in 2017 or 2018. And if you go forward, you know, 2 to 3 years, if you can use a 5-year-old spec'd phone or like a headset to do what the latest and greatest is doing, you know, after 5 years, then that's a really good place to be for a consumer perspective.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I think the eye tracking, like I would consider the Star VR 1 headset to be probably the first, I would call like Gen 2 display, because it crosses off like most of the requirements for Generation 2 in my rule book, at least. Where it has some sort of a difference in visual clarity, whether it's field of view or it's pixel resolution or pixel density. and it has eye tracking to do both IPG adjustment and foveated rendering, and you know all the other benefits you get, like the just UI interaction, social VR, all that good jazz.
But the question remains: does it override your visual cortex?
What do you mean?
I mean, isn't the CEO of Magic Leap always saying that their device is overriding your visual cortex?
I don't know what he means by that.
I mean, no one knows what it means.
What the fuck does that
mean? I don't know. I've been reading like those reviews from The Verge and also listening to their podcast. And I mean, what they describe is that the guy is basically riding around and talking about the Magic Leap, like, you know, super cool and it does all fancy stuff, and what he's describing is how light works. So there's light going into your eyes and you see it. It's not overriding your visual cortex, but I mean, the question remains, is a Star VR headset going to override your visual cortex or not?
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome, I'll tell you that. Like, it felt awesome to be in places and just look around. I saw a Porsche demo that was a company that made it. It was this German company that I actually helped them with a mixed reality video once. I wonder if it was Ignite. But anyway, they built they've been working with Porsche on their showroom experiences for people to customize their cars and then buy them in the dealership. And they just like were maxing out reflections on every single material that they could. They were using like really high resolution leather textures inside, like just everything was super reflective and shiny. And they're like, yeah, it runs like a champ, which is pretty cool. So yeah, this is the benefits that you get from foveated rendering. And I think moving forward, like people, whatever, you know, computer they have today or are buying over the next couple of years will be more than enough to be able to run VR. And especially when it comes to like, you know, how NVIDIA is optimizing their hardware for VR, it's going to become easier and easier to use.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of curious because NVIDIA has recently announced their new GPU series with some kind of dedicated ray tracing units, so I'm really looking forward to see what results ray tracing units can be used to, you know, enhance VR too.
Yes. I wonder what the 10 giga rays means, because
it's 10 like million rays per second. I don't think it's that much. I don't think it's that little. So with ray tracing, what you basically do is you need to, what you do is basically what baking light in Unity means. So you send a ray out, right, and it reflects and reflects and reflects, and that way you basically would calculate, you know, proper reflections on how things are light, because whenever you see an object, the object reflects light from other objects that get it from other objects, is getting it from other objects that getting it from the light source, and because, you know, the amount of rays bumping from each other is exponential, and also like how many jumps they do, then those 10 giga rays is, I guess, probably enough to, you know, highlight a cup in front of you, or maybe a whole scene, but needs to be seen. If anyone is an expert and wants to join us on an episode and talk about giga rays, reach out to us.
Yeah, or ray tracing. Yeah. I think we're always interested in that. It's been cool ever since I've been like doing more photogrammetry and understanding kind of how light works. It's just so fascinating to see how graphics technology has been progressing forward, especially like ray tracing is extremely interesting. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we're apparently now we're at the day and age where we can do ray tracing in real time with at least their super high end RTX GPU, but
it will come at some
point. It will come at some point. So, yeah, one last footnote I want to throw in there is I saw MPC, which is a VFX film kind of conglomerate. They were showing off a virtual production pipeline where they use Unity, where both the set designer and like the director meet up inside of VR, can walk around, mark locations, put in, move certain things around the set and like do the scouting for the shots. And then they even built like this typical equipment that you would use on a set. So like a full on dolly and track, the same like very high end tripod device controllers that you would have on set, and even like a, something that would be able to pull focus, and like panel tilt kind of rotational devices. It's like, these are, this honestly, this is equipment that I've never really used, because like I don't work with equipment on that level. But for the people that they work with, like direct, like DPs, cinematographers that have been doing, using that same equipment for 40 years, they wanted to build an experience that uses the advantages of like the real world, right, of their muscle memory to use that equipment, but with all the benefits that you get with a virtual set, that you can, you know, just essentially do a scene, like shoot a scene in real time that gets keyframed and recorded, and then be able to replay that scene and then just fine tune little adjustments. So they had like a live session with five people, like one person that was, I was a set designer in VR, kind of like floating around and moving the sun source. And then they had a person controlling the dolly, a person controlling the focus pan and tilt, and a person controlling the like Y position of the camera. And this is, I guess, similar to how a real film production would work with big cameras. And it was cool to see, you know, like how Hollywood is starting to understand, you know, how this technology will help them and starting to use that in their productions. And I believe they use this technology for Ready Player One.
Ooh.
And they, and yeah, Steven Spielberg was like super, you know, hyped up about it because he could do some virtual scouting in the scene and find better camera positions and be able to do a lot of pre-visualization that way.
I think there's also another use case. I mean, even if you not necessarily end up doing the real shots in VR with the scene, you can at least train, right? I mean, in a sense, what I could imagine is someone is doing a photogrammetry scan of the scene where you're going to film, putting it in VR, and then you basically are doing, you know, training shots before you actually film it on the side.
That's true. Very true. You can train, or even try out new like devices. That's a new category I recently was exposed to, like Lowe's. Lowe's built a VR app for you to try like new hedge trimmers and like new chainsaws. Like Lowe's is a home improvement, or like just a hardware store in America.
That's so funny.
And yeah, no, it's cool, man. Like I think that's like such a, that could be a genre of thing moving forward, is to try before you buy of certain products that work out, that could work in VR, whether it's a car or even a display or a screen or furniture in your room, or it's a piece of equipment that you're going to buy, you know, I think that that's pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so that was all of SIGGRAPH that I saw. There's a few things I did get to see behind closed doors that I can't talk about, but hopefully soon, I think, some of them are just kind of waiting on an announcement date. But yeah, but no, I did see some a few other things behind closed doors that we'll be able to see soon enough. And I, like I said, SIGGRAPH this year, I think this was my first year that I've been to it, but I didn't know there was going to be a VFX side. Like that's the bigger part of the conference, is the VFX industry. But it was just amazing to see the people behind the films that, you know, I grew up watching, and seeing what their pipelines look like, seeing how so much of it intersects now with the game industry and with Unity and Unreal kind of really bridging that gap between the game industry and the film industry. And I think VR also is like right smack dab in the middle of that. And it's starting to get the benefits of the talent from both. And this conference really highlighted that. There's so much research as well. I went to a poster session, and I honestly, like, I would say at least 40% of the papers that they presented there all like had VR as part of the research. Like whether they were researching new display technologies, or they're just using VR as a tool in their research, like that to me is what also makes me so happy. Originally, you know, coming into this field from like the CogSci perspective, the lab that I was in was using VR as a tool, and we're really starting to see that a lot more now, despite it just being a, you know, an information, or an, despite it being a entertainment device for, like, you know, most consumers for now, but there's a lot of serious innovation happening with it.
Yeah, you know what's kind of very interesting? Like, I mean, I guess I'm very, very, very receptive to it, but I see, like, a lot of people on the internet, people usually do on the internet say, you know, VR is dead, or whatever. Like, there's a lot of those particular things that I think the average consumer seems not to yet got hold of a VR headset or whatever. Now, on the other hand, you see, like, so much innovation happening in terms of hardware, so much innovation happening in terms of storytelling, in terms of, I mean, even, like, the average game on, you know, the Oculus Go stores that I experienced is just way better than anything that, you know, I tested out 3 years ago with the Gear VR, and the same goes, you know, for desktop VR headsets. It's just amazing. I mean, the hype around Beat Saber, right? So many people play it, and so many people love it, and whenever I, in those days, show VR, you know, I just put people in Beat Saber and just love it. So there's just amazing content coming out, and what I'm always surprised is to see that, you know, most of the hardware stores, even in Germany, have some kind of VR setup there that people can try, and it's
nice.
It's moving also for the professionals, whether they're engineers or filmmakers or whatever. They're also exploring the technology, and I think the medium itself seems to be coming more towards some kind of level where it's mature. I mean, particularly the Star VR example, right? I mean, just remember a few years ago, you would have some kind of very expensive monitors that is color calibrated and a standard monitor. And when you look at, you know, the prices today for an average monitor, they're pretty low, and the thing can display still very good colors. And I mean, you don't need to spend, you know, $20,000 for a monitor that can do some really, 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 really good magic, but you can spend way less. And same goes for TV, same goes for smartphones, right? I mean, with smartphones,
you can use your iPhone.
It's more about design that they're competing than the features. And with VR, there is still so much. I mean, each headset could right now have a distinct feature. Like, one headset will say, okay, we have eye tracking. The other headset could say, okay, but we have some kind of haptics attached to it or whatever, or some kind of EEG. So there is still so much room for innovation and improvement, and so much science and stuff that can be done with it. So it's amazing to see it.
Yeah, the in terms of the health of the industry, man, like, the clear indicator if something is, like, not working and if it was just overhyped and a fad is when you see, like, the enterprise side of that industry dying, or, like, just people, you know, businesses not really finding much use cases. And really, honestly, on the higher end, the enterprise side,
they're doing very well,
like, stronger than ever, and they're really figuring out how this works, or how it's working for them, and how it reduces costs and increases productivity.
Absolutely.
Or whatnot. And that to me is what really shows that there is huge potential, and eventually a lot of that technology trickles down. Like, I posted the video of the FOV comparison of the Star VR headset to, like, a few subreddits, and, like, in a few of them, I got some hate back from people saying, oh, you know, like, what would I ever care about something, you know, I can't buy it, or, like, specifically because it's not a consumer product. But I guess I failed to realize that people don't understand how this works, where, you know, it's the enterprise side of things that drive innovation at first, because the enterprise clients are willing to pay for that innovation.
Yeah.
And then as that happens, the economies of scale come in and drive prices down to the consumer side. Like, I was almost gonna write back to the person and be like, have you ever, like, been in a car before that has crashed and you haven't died? Like, all of that is because of motorsports, and motorsport is, like, the enterprise of, you know, of auto.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have to spend billions of dollars on building all these crazy technologies, like carbon fiber, even, for enterprise. And then that eventually becomes a consumer product. So, yeah, people, I mean, this, at least the listeners of this podcast are much more on the within the industry rather than just being consumers of the industry. And I think you guys understand this, but yeah, I guess there's a lot of work to be done on the consumer side, for them to understand what to follow, you know, and what has value and what doesn't, and what will affect them over the next couple of years.
Sure. I mean, there's still people around who, you know, are against smartphones. Maybe they have good reasons, but I think with every technology, you see some kind of backlash from the average consumer because he doesn't see the value. And to me, it's rather surprising that something like those home assistants like Alexa are just so widely accepted by consumers, just go and buy them without even considering anything. And I think VR is just way harder to explain the benefit before you try it. So I guess there's just this negativity because you just cannot understand why you would use it, what it is for, before you put it on and actually experience it. And, well, if you have some bad experiences because you, you know, got some free cardboard and tried some shitty apps, I guess you didn't try VR.
That's okay. Honestly, like, even people like that, that it's not, they aren't the things that are holding the industry no. back. You know, it's, it, we shouldn't worry about that. And just, we got to worry about, like, building valuable and better experiences that than stuff that we've seen and tried. And I hope some of the topics that we talk about here, you know, the creators that we bring on, help kind of shed light onto the topics and the things that they have found to be valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we at the Research VR want you to make better products.
Yes.
and hopefully you will use some of the science and design that you've heard on this podcast for it.
And then come back and talk about.
Yes. Okay, so let's do our outro. I want to read our Patreon supporters because you are amazing people. And again, if you don't already know, we do have a Patreon that you can help contribute to so that we can keep the lights on in here. So I'm going to start with Chris Orris, Hector Modrigan, Hypno Zero, Jesse Benson, Ken Harper, Mark Gillis, Nima Caspian, Nicole Aptekar, One Third Blue, RBS, Rob K, Ruben Langwin, Ryan Sullivan, and Shannon Mullins. Thank you all so much for your contributions. And for people that haven't yet found the Patreon, the link is down in the description. It is under Wizard of Oz, and it's a combination of the Research VR podcast and the YouTube channel for the photogrammetry projects that I've been doing. So find us there. Help us go to more conventions and more places that we can check out VR and report back for you all. And if there are specific products or companies or even topics that you want us to cover more on, or even if there's, this is actually something we want to encourage, is like, you know, if there's science that we've been talking about that you have different evidence for than what, you know, we concluded to, please, you know, throw it our way. We are happy to see it and read it if it's in a critical format. And not just trash talk. And honestly, I have to say, we have not gotten like bad emails from our listeners or like trash talk from our listeners. I think you guys are a very high quality bunch that if there's things that you want to disagree on, it's always done in a very, in like a constructive way that it actually leads to conversation and it leads to people actually changing their minds. That I think is a very, very, very valuable thing, especially on the internet today. Absolutely. Which is kind of hard. So, apologies for this month being at SIGGRAPH, missed an episode. But we will, replacing it with this one. Hopefully this will go out this week, like on a quick way.
And who knows, next month in October. Maybe in October I will do, I have still to see and don't want to announce it, but maybe there will be some live stuff. Let's see.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, that's a matter of like having someone helping us produce it so that, you know, we can concentrate on actually talking and hosting rather than worrying about live streaming. But perhaps there'll be some more there.
Yeah, I have also some ideas about some scientist gatherings that we could stream or whatever. So let's see if it works out.
That would be this thing. Find us on Discord as well, y'all. We are like almost up to 130 now. It's been growing quicker than before. And also the quality of conversations that we've been having there is also quite high.
It's amazing.
It's really good. And honestly, I'm not like trying to grow it in number size. I realized like, you know, we can post it on Reddit or we can post it on random VR communities and have people populate it. But I really want the people in the Discord to be people that listen to this podcast that are, you know, at least somewhat mature with how they approach these topics and want to like approach it in a way that they can learn and, or perhaps they can learn from others or they can teach others.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think with scale, certain groups become just way too hard to control, or like having conversations just doesn't work. Like, I'm sure any of you are in some kind of a Slack group that has way too many people and you just never want to go onto it because either your voice won't be heard or just, you know, a cluster fest of at everyone's coming at you. So we don't have that. I think the rate of conversation on the Discord is actually kind of slow, and it leads to just better constructed arguments and
yeah, but also the responses are usually kind of very long, which is good because people actually take the time to answer, including me. If you're waiting for an answer from me, I take my time, do my research, and sometimes it's slow, but at least it's appropriate.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, this is where we're going a little bit over today. Maybe if you guys want more longer form podcasts as well, let us know, because we've been trying to limit ourselves to an hour, which I think is a healthy medium between, you know, people that like long podcasts and people that like it short. But maybe there's some room for us blabbering on some a little bit longer.
Yes,
let's be curious to see that. Also, we should organize our next show and tell so that we can have people pop into VR again and we could do kind of another meetup of listeners. Yes. Last time was really fun. And so we most likely will announce it for a time in September. Mm-hmm. We're scheduling our next set of recordings for the podcast, and we have, I guess we're going to have people on from Oculus Medium. Actually, that's going to be a really fun conversation. They recently had a big update. Yeah, we'll announce more about the guests that are coming on soon.
Yeah, and by the way, so, if you're still listening after this long time, also maybe spend 1 or 2 minutes to rate us, share us, make sure we have, you know.
Yes, honestly, a rating on iTunes would be incredible. They don't make it too easy to do it, honestly, and you either have to do it through iTunes on a computer, or if you have an iPhone, you can go into your podcasts app and I believe you can leave us a review there. It really, really would help. We don't have that many reviews, and I think we could for sure use some more so that it helps us actually rank up on the podcastings page.
Exactly. And yeah, you can also, you know, if you're bored or you have free time or you really, really want to support us, there is obviously not just a Patreon way. The Patreon way is the best to ensure that we could at some point go to a conference. But, you know, just share here and there the episode when it's fitting in some kind of conversations on the internet. Because if you think the episode was, informative and helped you to learn something, it might be also good for others. Spread the word.
All right. I think we should wrap it up.
Hooray!
Thank you all for listening. And thank you for our supporters. You guys are awesome. Enough self-promotion for today. And we'll see you guys next time.
Goodbye.